beautifully tricky things that it causes the person who is an existentialist really to take that introspective journey, as Hugh Laffalette is suggesting, to figure out what emotional responses are triggered by what, to figure out what characteristics you gravitate towards, to really examine the things that make you reach out to individuals. But then also to realize the difference of when you are reaching out to an individual because of what they can offer you in terms of the traits they possess, and when you are reaching out to an individual because you desire who they are. Or you, desire is not the right term. You recognize, and maybe you desire to be more like them, but you pursue them with the intentionality to understand who they are as a historically embodied creature. And I guess I never really broke that down to say what a historically embodied creature in Laffalette terms means. It means a person, mostly, well, yeah, person, but more directly a being, a person's being in a historical context. So within a temporal context, to say this person has journeyed through time and space and had these experiences which have accentuated certain characteristics, hidden other ones, and now you are coming across them in your pursuit of time and space in the world around you, and you gravitate towards them, and you desire to dwell with them, to understand who they are, to understand who they were, and together you actually are coming to understand who both of you could be in a connected sense and in an individual sense, because even for Laffalette, these personal relationships change who you are if you take time to look at them and see why they are invoking such strong emotions.
And with that, I do have some more quotations, which I think go to exactly what you're talking about here. So an emotion standardly has an object. The object is thought to explain that emotion. And then Laffalette quotes the American philosopher Richard Rorty. To fully explain, we must identify an event or a series of events long forgotten and which formed a set of dispositions which are triggered by the immediate cause. It requires analyzing the magnetizing effects of the formation of our emotional dispositions, habits of thought, as well as habits of action and response. Magnetizing dispositions are dispositions that gravitate toward and create conditions that spring from other dispositions. A magnetizing disposition to irascibility not only involves a set of specific low thresholds, but also involves looking for frustrating conditions, perceiving situations as frustrating. Then he has, I think, a much more simple way of saying this, which is, put differently, our emotions standardly focus on some object, a thing, person, or event. Moreover, the emotion typically reflects some evaluation of the object. Our emotions are partly constituted by these objects and evaluations. Partly. For had our causal histories been different, our emotional responses would likely be different. Perhaps we would not become so jealous so easily if we had felt loved by our parents and our friends. Perhaps we would not become so angry quickly if we had not been regularly frustrated as a child. The distinction between the object and the causal history of our emotions helps answer a significant question about emotions, namely, whether we ever use them for some purpose. Some theorists have thought so, but other theorists have denied that people use emotions for these purposes. We could use emotions for our, so he's quoting another author here, another theorist. We could use emotions for our purpose, he avows, only if we could deliberately choose our emotions. However, since we cannot induce emotions at will, we cannot use emotions as instruments of our purposes. Although this response looks plausible, it commits what I call the rationalistic fallacy, the belief that we intentionally choose all our beliefs, attitudes, and behavior. We don't. Our emotions, beliefs, and attitudes are the products of complex causal histories. Intentional choices play a role in these histories, but they do not produce and direct.
The fact that we don't really choose our emotions arise out of our encountering the objects which kind of stimulate or cause them to arise. I think that's a good reminder. I think it's interesting. There's an interesting case in terms of introspection. So when we go back in memory to evaluate our feelings, for La Follette, that would mean recalling behaviors. We can't really go into ourselves and just check our, you know, put our feelings under a microscope. That's not what investigating our emotions is. It's, oh, I reacted this way in this situation. I must have been feeling a certain way. I think it's a good reminder of the publicity of it. It does kind of, part of it makes me question whether we can or cannot choose our emotions, because we can recall events that put us back in certain situations. I mean, certain ways of doing stoicism involve recalling things and manipulating mental impressions to induce certain feelings. So there may be a workaround to that, but I definitely agree with the criticism of just like pure decision, you know, put your finger on this emotion, we want to be this way. It takes work to feel a certain way if you're going to do it at all, or if it's even possible.
And La Follette isn't actually finished with this argument. He later goes on to state, in short, emotions are habits, and habits are not under direct control. But that should be unsurprising. Most of what we do is not under direct control. We are habitual creatures. Emotions are just one type of habit. Thinking is another. If we are inclined to carefully and critically reflect on important issues, we will, in most circumstances, think critically about an issue. We do not have to decide to do so. Understanding that emotions are habits explains some phenomena that Descartes and Freud sought to explain. For instance, it explains why we sometimes maintain an emotional response which is inconsistent with our evaluations and beliefs. If we want to change our shoes or our hat, we simply change them. Habits, though, are not taken on and off at will. We may decide to control appetite, restrain anger, or get in a good mood, all to no avail. Why? Because these are habits, deeply entrenched dispositions, not amenable to direct volitional control.
With all of this in mind, with understanding the importance of seeing people as historically embodied creatures playing a major role in personal relationships, and with our greater mission in mind of coming to see whether the existentialism actually can help or harm exploration within relationships, let's do a recap of where we've been and then how we got here. And then I will have a panel discussion about whether the question is actually answered. So we started looking at Nietzsche, and we looked at the eternal return a little bit. What would you do if you were forced to relive the same day over and over and over again? Would you embrace the freedom? Or would you, in anger, clash your teeth and shout out in frustration? We talked about the God is dead statement. What does that mean for existentialist thought? To say that for Nietzsche, this was not a moment of celebration. Rather, this was a moment of great emotional and social turmoil, because now humanity is strictly responsible for their actions and the repercussion that reaps. There is no way to be restored in a sense to what you formerly were. You have to bear the burden of what you experience. We touched on Sartre multiple times with his three kind of state assessment of the state of the existential man, that you are forlorn, you are alone, and you are in despair. You are fundamentally individually responsible. But because you are individually responsible, the choices you make have repercussions for everyone around you. Because, again, there's no supreme deity to help restore you to what you were. So every action has a repercussion that you have to carry. And so to understand the role of existential responsibility can be seen in both Nietzsche and Sartre. Kierkegaard, we talked about the stages of life. We talked about the stage of life for the existentialist, the life of the ascetic, which is a life that is fear-based, that is alone, which is caused, which is lived in fear of pain and retribution. Then we talked about going to the life of the ethical, in which you find community, but you're still fundamentally alone because your ethical framework may be different to those of your colleagues. And then we talked about the leap of faith and the life of the religious, that you empty yourself out for an infusion of divine grace. That ultimately, for Kierkegaard, you could link Martin Buber in with this as well, and the relationship between the you, which is you obviously, and the thou, the thing that cannot be understood but can be experienced. And then we talked about our town to give a more contextual example of existential dread and existential investigation, and how Emily demonstrates a desire to step out of her very defined role and to discover who she is, but only actually finds the freedom to do that in death, and comes to the realization that most people are blind. Do any people truly live it? Do any people ever see it as they live it every minute? And to which the stage manager replies, saints and poets, maybe they do some. To talk about how as we live our lives, we tend to live our lives on autopilot, not being aware of how every action we do impacts the future that we have. I'm not understanding, not intentionally seeking and asking questions to uncover who another person is. Rather, they're my mom, so they're my mom, versus saying, yeah, they're your mom, that's true. But who is the person underneath the label of your mom? And then we go to my personal philosophical heavyweight. We go to Martin Heidegger. We look at, again, a very individualistic view of the world, because in existentialism, the world is not the planet. The world is your individual expression and experience of the world as you go through it. And so Heidegger raises the question of what is being? What does it mean to be? What does it mean to be in the world? What does it mean to be in relationship? Heidegger seeks that out, and he has some angst about him, because he says Dasein is the only thing where its own existence is an issue for it. So Dasein's mission is to answer the question, why do I exist? And how it seeks to do that is through through experience, through reaching out and taking in and uncovering things and phenomenon and experience. Well, now we're talking about Hugh Laffalette, and we talked about Hugh Laffalette a little bit last episode as well. To say we've gone from two people, we've gone from Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, who are fundamentally individualistic, that you have to make a choice. It's up to you to choose. Of course, you have Kierkegaard, the little bit of the exception, which is the leap of faith, but still that's a leap you have to take. You have to be willing to empty yourself to receive that infusion of divine grace. We've gone through all these people that are fundamentally individualistic, whereas Hugh Laffalette tries to bring in a much more communal two-person aspect to all of that.
At the end of chapter 2 on emotions, which I was mainly quoting from, once again, we see how a mistaken understanding of ourselves hampers relationships. If we are preoccupied with how we feel rather than how we act, we may misdescribe our own emotions. If we fail to recognize that our emotions are habits, we may make misguided attempts to alter them. Both of these mistakes will diminish our ability to create and sustain meaningful relationships. Existentialism provides us so many tools with processing our actions, our emotions, and our feelings in constructive ways that are both philosophically interesting and actually useful in the real world.
Yet it seems to suggest that those tools may also be so numerous that they are overwhelming and actually get in the way of that exploration.
I mean, I would push back on that and say that you only have to choose the tools that work for you. It's not like you have to choose every existentialist. You only need to choose the few existentialists that actually work for you. Just explore that process.
Who knew we were going to turn Aaron into an existentialist by the end of the show?
You don't got me yet. I'm still skeptical on existentialism. I'm just giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Technically, every existentialist is skeptical of themselves anyway, so there you go.
Existentialism is such an illuminating branch of philosophy, I think specifically because it seeks to find the kind of core structures of our existence. Laffalette is doing a kind of existentialism in that he is trying to concretize our experience of relations rather than, I mean, he has to do something kind of abstract. I mean, when you're drawing distinctions like historical and rigid, you're doing abstraction, but it's abstraction, quite the opposite of, it's abstraction in the service of a lived, embodied life. I think that is kind of the credo or the fundamental project of existentialism, trying to elaborate thoughts that actually serve life, that illuminate the meaning in it, that make it more intelligible, that introduce clarity to it, even if that means giving it some ambiguity, like Kierkegaard's leap of faith, because life might just actually be that way, you know? So I think that the existentialist project, I'm kind of giving this answer because I'm anticipating you, Tegan, asking the question that you've been raising throughout the show, that the existentialist project gives us lots of frameworks for understanding things, but does it take us out of life while we are making this investigation? Does it kind of overstep its own bounds? Does it step on its own foot in a way? I have to kind of admit that I think it does a little bit, but I don't think that that is necessarily the fault of existentialism. I think that that is just, and I think the existentialists are quite aware of this, that this is kind of built into the structure of existence itself. So the existentialists would be quite aware of that. There is a very famous kind of quote from Hegel, the end of the preface to the Philosophy of Right. He says that the owl of Minerva spreads its wings only with the coming of the dusk, which essentially means you can only understand something, which means you can only give something meaning after the fact that it has happened. So if the existentialist is trying to understand something, trying to understand their life, understand some situation, it's only going to happen after the fact. You can't understand things in advance, and you are in the middle of something, and so you're busy getting caught up in the world. You can't necessarily understand things as they are happening. I think this is best exemplified by our town, where Emily dies and then goes back and experiences the meaning of things. I mean, you can kind of step out of the world for a moment and reflect on it and think about things. It's difficult to... I mean, this is the perennial problem, isn't it? It's difficult to be in the moment in a certain way. When you try to be in the moment, you come up against this edge case of trying to be in it, but also perceive it and understand it. You're kind of grinding the gears of reality in a way. Do I think that the existentialist kind of steps on their own, you know, steps in their own way? Maybe. I don't know if that's necessarily their fault. I don't know if there's anything they can do about that. And I don't even know if trying to overcome that is even desirable. I think that there is something kind of, when I read and I think about our town, there is something kind of tragically bittersweet about people living their lives, being, I don't want to say ignorant of it. They're not bad people because they're in the midst of their lives. I think that's quite, I think there's something beautiful about that, that, you know, after the fact, you kind of get something afterwards. You get to remember it. And I think the existentialist comes very close to understanding reality.
In chapter 12, at the end, he says this in his conclusion. Selves are not unchangeable entities which decide now exactly what they will do into the indefinite future. That is why verbally announcing my intention to be your friend indefinitely is, if disconnected from my behavior, an empty gesture. Rather, the self is dynamic and constantly changing. Bare psychic intentions, utterance to ourselves about what we plan to do, about the indefinite future, are, in and of themselves, inefficacious. Genuine intentions are embodied. These can make that future more likely. This is true not merely for personal relationships, but in all our endeavors. For instance, I will skip that example. This conclusion should not be surprising. Most of us know that our relationships which persist and are worth preserving are those in which people behaviorally commit themselves to one another. That is, they act in ways which ensure they will regularly communicate with one another. On the one hand, many who engage in mere formal verbal commitments are not likely to have enduring relationships. Since the traditional dualistic view of self indicates that formal commitments are not only reasonable but sufficient, whereas an active activity view of the self suggests that commitment is determined more by what we do than by what we say, then we have one more reason to favor the activity view of self. And from chapter 13, in his conclusion, he says this on good moral behavior. In short, the possibility of general personal relationships is invigorated, if not eliminated, in an unjust environment. More specifically, a person is unlikely to have close relationships unless she is moral. So Lafayette's point that here in the last chapter is that being a moral person doesn't prevent you from having personal relationships, as many philosophers have basically said, that if you wish to be moral, then you have to kind of isolate yourself from society and the way other people make their decisions. So Lafayette says, no, this is not the case. We can make moral decisions, and this, in fact, makes us better at personal relationships, not worse.
It is worth noting that existentialism is a school of thought that is deep and wide, and we have only begun to scratch the surface of a couple of the pivotal players. To answer the question, does the existentialist spend so much time in the abstract that they miss the moment? Or Can we get so caught up in the moment of introspection that we miss the entire picture? I would say no. I would say because sometimes you need to spend time in the abstract to understand the significance of the moments that you've experienced. And yet, I would say sometimes the abstract can be a safe place to go when we don't know how quite to interpret the moments that are ahead of us. I think what every existentialist will tell you is that they are no one without the people who have come before them. That it is directly because of the people that they read and they worked with and they invested in that helped make their thought as powerful as it is. So, before you say goodbye to coffee and sunrises and sunsets, take a couple moments to think about what you want your life to be going forward. And I think you've made the existentialists proud. Take care, everyone. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. And the existentialism miniseries is complete. With Tegan Marshall, Aaron Wang, Brandon Brownlee.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
Do you have to point the finger at me? You cheat, you lie, you steal and lie. Have to pretend that I do not see. Victim coming to follow me. Liar, denier, endlessly. Liar, denier, you are. Victim commits a felony.